Ready to find your next favorite podcast? Spotify makes it easier than ever to discover new favorites by previewing short audio clips before committing to a full listen. You can even watch some podcasts with video or just keep playing audio in the background. It's everything you want in one app. Music, podcasts, and audiobooks across any device. Play anytime, anywhere, any way you'd like with Spotify. Try today.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of this woman's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of murder that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13.
By 2006, 33-year-old Michelle Hughes Linehan was living out her dreams, married to a successful, handsome doctor, and raising a family on Washington's scenic Olympic Peninsula, just 60 miles from Seattle.
She took advantage of all the Pacific Northwest had to offer, participating in kayaking, biking, hiking, and rock climbing. She was also an avid reader and gardener, and well known in her circle of friends for her wonderful dinner parties.
If you asked anyone who knew her, they would comment on how caring she was. Once, when a contractor was caught stealing from her, she told the police that she forgave him. He described her as very compassionate and very understanding.
After a rough early life, Michelle had finally found everything she ever wanted.
Little did she know, her old life in Alaska would soon come knocking. After a cold case unit uncovered new evidence, Michelle was about to be charged with the murder of Kent Lepink.
Picture a murderer, a gangster, a thief. Did you picture a woman? We didn't think so. Society associates men with dangerous crimes. But what happens when the perpetrator is female? Every Wednesday, we examine the psychology, motivations, and atrocities of female criminals.
Hi, I'm Sammy Nye.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And you're listening to Female Criminals on the Parcast Network.
We're once again joined by Lainey Hobbs, the host of Parcast's new podcast, Crimes of Passion. Her show follows passionate crimes, exploring what manipulates relationships into deadly results.
Thanks, Vanessa. Hello, female criminals listeners.
This week, we continue the story of Michelle Linehan, one of Alaska's most notorious murder suspects, accused of convincing a man to kill her fiancé, Kent Lepink, in 1996.
She wasn't actually charged with his death until 2006, after a cold case unit discovered new, damning evidence that pointed to Michelle.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
In our last episode, we explored the early life of Michelle Hughes Linehan. In pursuit of a better life, she moved to Alaska, where she earned big bucks as one of Anchorage's most popular exotic dancers.
We also discussed the multiple romantic relationships she was entangled in. Michelle juggled 3 engagements at the same time in 1995, creating a breeding ground for jealousy that eventually led to Kent's murder.
This week, we'll see how investigators uncovered new evidence, finally leading to Michelle's arrest and trial.
Before he was killed in May of 1996, Kent sent a letter to his parents, Ken and Betsy, warning them that something bad might happen to him. He included another letter in the envelope, instructing his parents to only read that second letter if something bad happened to him.
When they learned of his murder, Ken and Betsy opened the second envelope. This letter from the grave pointed the finger at his fiancée, Michelle Hughes, and their two housemates, John Carlin and Scott Hilke.
But the letter was considered hearsay, and the case went nowhere. By the summer of 1996, Michelle, Scott, and John had all moved away from Alaska, and Kent's murder investigation went cold.
The unsolved murder haunted the detectives who worked on the case for years. In 2002, when Alaska received a federal grant to open a cold case unit, the Kent Lepink case was a top priority.
The file was assigned to an experienced retired state trooper named Jim Stogsdill. He had already worked a few cold cases since the unit's inception and had success. He was partnered with Detective Linda Blanchflower, a retired investigator with the Anchorage Police Department.
One of the first pieces of evidence that caught Jim's eye was something referred to as the Hope Note. Not much was made of it during the initial investigation, but Jim found it suspicious.
The Hope Note was a letter from John Carlin to Michelle informing her that she was invited to use a cabin he recently purchased in Hope, Alaska. Hope was the nearest town to the site where Kent Lepping's body was discovered.
Carlin wrote that he had fixed the roof and cleaned the fireplace. He added at the end, "You guys enjoy your stay."
Michelle inexplicably wrote back on the note, quote, "Great. Please don't let anyone know where we're at. Love you and thanks again," end quote.
But there was no record that John ever owned a cabin in Hope. Jim came to the conclusion that the note was a hoax, intended for Kent to find and make him jealous.
Jim theorized that John and Michelle wrote the note to lure Kent to Hope, thinking he would catch Michelle with another man. But Michelle was in Lake Tahoe with Scott Hilke, and there was no cabin in Hope.
But evidently the note worked. Kent drove to Hope in the throes of despair and jealousy. He stopped in town and showed Michelle's picture to everyone he met, desperate for information on her whereabouts. This was clearly unhealthy.
Before we dig into Kent's psychology, just a quick disclaimer. Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Sammy. Kent had a long history of paranoia over Michelle's relationships with other men, once even flying across the country to check up on her. According to Dr. Carrie Barron, this functional type of paranoia is associated with delusional disorder of the persecutory type. Sufferers see themselves as especially perceptive and can sometimes act out with aggressive behavior or schemes based on what they think they perceive.
Once the Hope Note planted the suggestion in Kent's mind that Michelle was in a cabin with another man, he had to investigate. But he didn't find Michelle in the arms of her lover. The only thing he found was death.
In addition to this new theory about the Hope Note years after Kent's death, police had another breakthrough, thanks to recent advancements in technology. In the original investigation, police seized two computers, including the Gateway laptop that Michelle had instructed her sister to wipe clean, but they hadn't found anything of use. Using new forensic software, hundreds of deleted emails were recovered.
According to Detective Linda Branchflower, they were able to pull up emails between Kent and Michelle, Michelle and Carlin, and Michelle and Hilke that described different aspects of their relationship.
The emails elucidated Michelle's manipulation of the men in her life. One exchange between Michelle and Kent read, quote, "You should not be concerned about John. He's more of a brother or even a father to me," end quote.
But then she turned around and emailed John, buttering him up, writing, quote, "You are the most important thing in my life. I need you more than you will ever know," end quote.
Of course, being manipulative didn't make Michelle a murderer, but detectives also came across an email that seemed more sinister than the rest, which they referred to as the Seychelles email.
It was sent just days before Kent's body was discovered on May 2, 1996. Michelle wrote to John, quote, "Did you know that you can buy citizenship in the Seychelles for around $10 million? No matter what crimes you have committed, they will not extradite," end quote.
Detectives saw this as a clear indication that Michelle was considering starting a new life somewhere she could guarantee her freedom. The restored emails and the hope note were a great start, but investigators were determined to find something more concrete, namely the missing murder weapon.
Kent had been shot with an unusual gun, a .44 caliber Desert Eagle. Back in 1996, John Carlin had denied owning a gun when questioned by police. Michelle had suggested that Kent owned a Desert Eagle, but police were unable to locate the firearm.
It was Linda Branchflower who finally found information that John was lying about the gun, and she heard it from an unlikely source, John's son, young John.
At the time of Kent's murder, John had prevented authorities from interviewing his 17-year-old son alone. Both Jim and Linda suspected that young John could provide some key evidence. They were able to locate him in Tacoma, Washington.
In May of 2005, Linda and Jim flew to Tacoma and surprised young John at work. Although initially hesitant about being interviewed, young John eventually confided in the investigators.
He maintained that his father did not murder Kent Lepink, even going so far to say that he believed John Carlin wasn't involved in any way. However, he recalled that shortly after Kent's body was found, a gun fell out of a closet in his dad's house.
Michelle and John had panicked when young John picked it up, and they immediately washed the gun with bleach in the bathroom sink.
Young John was also certain his father had purchased a .44 Desert Eagle shortly after they arrived in Alaska.
When Linda returned from interviewing young John, she started looking for evidence to back up his claims. She went to the Anchorage Daily News and requested access to its catalog of previous editions.
In less than 2 hours, she found a classified ad selling a .44 Desert Eagle. The ad was placed in January of 1995, 6 weeks after Carlin had arrived in Alaska. Linda was even able to find the seller, who confirmed he sold the gun to a man, but he wasn't positive it was Carlin when Linda showed him a picture.
Still, the combination of the hope note, the recovered emails, and young John's statement about the gun in the closet was enough new evidence for investigators to present the case to a grand jury.
In the fall of 2006, over a decade after Kent Lepink was found dead, Michelle Hughes Linehan and John Carlin were indicted for his murder.
On October 4, 2006, Olympia police knocked on the front door of Michelle and Colin Linehan's suburban home. Colin answered. Michelle was out running errands.
The police informed him that they had a warrant for Michelle's arrest. They told Colin he had 1 hour to produce her, even going so far to say, "We can do this in a small way or in a big way."
Within the hour, Michelle, Colin, and their lawyer arrived at the Olympia police station. Michelle was arrested and placed on a flight to Anchorage that night.
Colin followed her north a few days later. Rich Galries, a bail bondsman, recalled his encounter with a young doctor at the Anchorage jail. He was struck by how devastated Colin seemed by what was happening to his wife.
Across the country in New Jersey, John Carlin learned that Alaska state troopers were going to arrest him. To avoid a confrontation with police at his home, Carlin flew to Anchorage and turned himself in, just days after the indictment came down.
Michelle was released on bail a few weeks after her arrest and allowed to return home wearing an electronic ankle bracelet. Unable to post bail, Carlin remained in the Anchorage jail pending his trial, scheduled for March 7, 2007.
Coming up, the judgment of John Carlin begins, and it quickly becomes apparent that Michelle and her racy past are on trial, too.
Now, back to the story.
Nearly a decade after Kent Lepink's murder, cold case investigators had finally cracked the case wide open. In October of 2006, 33-year-old Michelle Hughes Linehan and 49-year-old John Carlin were arrested for the crime.
From the start, their separate trials drew international media attention. The elements of the story seemed made in tabloid heaven. An ex-stripper turned doctor's wife, multiple engagements, a $1 million insurance policy, and a letter from the grave written by the victim, pointing the finger at his fiance.
The Linehan's Olympia neighbors were shocked by the charges levied against Michelle. None of them knew about her past as a stripper or anything about her time in Alaska. According to one neighbor, quote, "She's Michelle, a great gal. She's one of the sweetest people I know. I don't think I've ever been so shocked in my whole life," end quote.
After leaving Alaska, Michelle appeared to have made a complete 180 in her life. According to Dr. Romeo Vitelli of York University, while many factors of our personality are set by the time we reach adulthood, emotional trauma and life-changing events can change fundamental traits in a person.
It's possible that the chain of events that led to Kent's death also led to a change in Michelle's worldview.
Her manipulations of the people around her had escalated past her control, leading to a man's death. When she started a new life in New Orleans, she may have done so with a new outlook that changed how she treated others.
Michelle's family and friends in Olympia stuck by her. They told anyone who would listen that it was impossible that this devoted mother and wife could have possibly committed such a heinous crime.
The Alaska District Attorney decided to try John and Michelle separately for Kent's murder because of the differences in their involvement. Prosecutor Pat Gullifson would prove that John Carlin fired the gun, but it was Michelle who had convinced him to do so. Under Alaska law, they could both be convicted of first-degree murder.
John's trial was first. It began on March 7, 2007. Gullifson pulled no punches in his opening statements, describing Kent's murder as an execution. He showed the jurors a series of gruesome crime scene photos before dramatically ending on an image of Kent and Michelle happily posing together.
Gullifson told the jury, quote, "It's a story that's going to involve passion, greed, manipulation, and deception. And it's those explosive forces and the actions of John Carlin and of Michelle Hughes that just exploded on Kent Lempink in late April of 1996 and led to his death," end quote.
Gullifson first called a psychoanalyst to the stand. He testified about the psychology behind the three shots that killed Kent. He described the first two shots as business and the third shot, the one that hit Kent in the face, as personal.
Next, Gullifson presented the Hope Note to the jury as proof that Michelle and John had lured Kent to Hope, Alaska to kill him.
He followed this with the hundreds of recovered emails. The messages told an intriguing story of the Carlin household in the final months of Kent's life.
Linda Branchflower testified that the emails proved Carlin was completely controlled by Michelle. In one message he wrote, quote, "Michelle is the one I'd do anything in the world for, including give up my life," end quote.
Branchflower also testified about the Seychelles email and how Michelle appeared to be instructing John Carlin on how he could find a safe haven from the law.
But Gullifson's final witness, young John, was the most devastating.
He once again described seeing a gun in his father's house. Quote, "I remember coming around the corner and seeing Michelle and my father, and there was a firearm in the sink, and the sink was about half full with a clear liquid," end quote.
When Gullifson rested his case, he was confident that, although circumstantial, he had presented a compelling argument that John Carlin had conspired to murder Kent Lempink.
John's defense attorney, Sidney Billingsley, countered young John's testimony head-on. He accused young John of having an affair with Michelle behind his father's back, and that he was the one who fired the shot that killed Kent Lempink.
He presented search warrants and other documents from the original 1996 investigation that indicated young John was considered a suspect early on.
Billingsley called young John's ex-girlfriend, Adela Perez, to the stand. The two had dated from the summer of 1995 to the spring of 1996. She testified that young John was a compulsive liar and that, while he was always bizarre, he had become increasingly volatile around the end of their relationship, which coincided with the timing of Kent's murder.
Billingsley next called a neighbor, who testified that a few weeks after the murder, she saw young John climb onto the roof of the house, retrieve an item hidden in the gutter, and then climb back through a window.
Billingsley speculated that the neighbor had witnessed young John hiding the Desert Eagle on the roof so that police wouldn't find it.
If Michelle was concerned about the speculation on the nature of her relationship with young John, she didn't show it. She attended his father's trial one day and passed young John outside the courthouse. She ran up to him and hugged him, walking away with tears in her eyes.
In addition to presenting John's own son as an alternative suspect, Billingsley took aim at the recovered emails, stressing how ambiguous they actually were.
He presented additional messages to indicate that Kent and John Carlin were actually friends, despite the hell Michelle put them through. One email from Kent to John read, quote, "I value my friendships more than I value most things. Thanks for being a friend," end quote.
He also claimed that the hope note was a prank by John and Michelle. They wanted to mislead Kent so that Michelle could visit Scott Hilke in California without Kent interrupting them, as he had done in the past.
In his closing arguments, Billingsley reminded the jury that Kent would still be alive were it not for Michelle's expert deception and manipulation tactics. He said, quote, "The amount of juggling that she can do is extensive. She's manipulative, greedy, and has an explosive temper when she's crossed. People don't do what she wants them to do. She explodes," end quote.
The jury deliberated for 2 days, then returned with a verdict on April 3, 2007. They found John Carlin guilty of murder in the first degree.
Billingsley asked to delay John Carlin's sentencing hearing until after Michelle's trial in the fall of 2007. The prosecutor agreed, and Judge Volland set John's sentencing for November 9, 2007.
Michelle's trial began in September of 2007. She also faced Judge Volland and Pat Gullifson, which proved to be a major strike against her.
As was the case with John Carlin, Gullifson did not have to prove that Michelle fired the gun herself to find her guilty of first-degree murder. He told the court, quote, "If it wasn't for Michelle Linehan, Kent Lepink would still be alive today. All she needed was somebody to do the dirty work, somebody to pull the trigger," end quote.
Gullifson called many of the same witnesses that appeared at John's trial and presented much of the same evidence, including the hope note and Seychelles email.
He took aim at Michelle's new image as a suburban housewife, saying, quote, "Underlying the whole defense is that she's a changed woman. That doesn't mean that we forget about a murder that she was involved in and instrumental in committing 11 years ago," end quote.
To keep the focus on Michelle's seedy past, Gullifson called another dancer from the Alaskan Bush Company, Laura Aspiotis, to the stand. Laura claimed that she and Michelle watched the movie The Last Seduction together. In the film, Linda Fiorentino's character manipulates her lover into killing her husband for a $700,000 payout, eventually letting him take the fall as she walks away scot-free.
Laura testified that after they were finished watching the movie, Michelle said that she wanted to be just like Linda Fiorentino.
But under cross-examination, Laura's story fell apart. Her memory was hazy when she was pressed on certain details. When her diary was brought into evidence, it was revealed that she had actually watched the movie with her husband.
However, Laura's testimony was so juicy, it ended up dominating the news coverage of the trial.
Gullifson also called the life insurance agent who issued the $1 million policy for Kent to the stand. The agent testified that Michelle called just days before the murder to check whether or not the policy was still in effect.
The state trooper who interviewed Michelle the day after Kent's murder testified about her demeanor during the interview. He said, quote, "I've done a lot of death notification, and it just seemed to me she lacked a bit of sincerity," end quote.
Once again, Gullifson called young John to the stand. He repeated the story about Michelle and his dad washing a gun that fell out of the closet.
But now that young John had told the story several times, Michelle's lawyers were able to point out some inconsistencies. His description of where Michelle was when the gun was being washed was different from what he had described in his father's trial.
His testimony seemed to have less of an impact this time around. Still, Gullifson felt he had presented a strong case.
He referred to the last seduction in his closing argument, saying, quote, "If she's the one who's going to write the ending to this, it's going to be just like the movie, isn't it? Problem is, you're going to write the ending. She isn't. It's going to be a true and just ending because the proof is beyond a reasonable doubt that she aided and abetted and solicited the murder of Kent Lepping. And it's time to hold her accountable for that," end quote.
Michelle's defense team focused on selling her as a changed woman, a mom, and a doctor's wife. But her past as a stripper, juggling multiple engagements, would prove insurmountable with the jury, which was composed of 11 women.
Michelle commented later that she felt the jury was watching her every move. Quote, "I didn't want to look at the jury. If I smiled, it made me bad. And if I cried, I was guilty. I felt like no matter what I did, it wasn't right," end quote.
Studies show that throughout legal history, women who commit murder are often judged more harshly by juries. This is especially true when the woman on trial is deemed to be in any way immoral. Barrister Helena Kennedy, who represented Moore's murderer, Myra Hindley, explained that there's a psychological need for juries to punish women who they deem to have done something counter to the rules of womanhood.
Michelle briefly considered testifying, but her lawyers were certain she'd be eaten alive by Gullifson on the stand. Instead, they called her husband, Colin Linehan, to present a different side of Michelle to the jury, the wife, mother, and good neighbor. But his testimony did not appear to have much of an impact on the jury, especially when her own attorney had to admit Michelle's character was questionable.
In his closing statements, Michelle's defense attorney conceded that she had indeed behaved badly during her time in Anchorage and made no excuse for how she had treated the men in her life.
But he also called for the jury to exercise fair judgment of his client and remember what she was actually on trial for. He said, quote, "All this mudslinging at Mrs. Linehan shows immaturity in relationships, shows confusion in the relationships, shows lack of honesty in the relationships, demonstrates she said some lousy things, but you know what? She's not charged with any of those things. None of this proves that she solicited the murder of Kent Lepping," end quote.
But the jury wasn't swayed. On October 22, 2007, they returned a guilty verdict.
After the verdict was read, Michelle slumped into her chair. Her husband knelt beside her and buried himself into her shoulder, weeping. Michelle and Colin embraced until guards finally came over and pulled her away.
After the hearing, a juror named Christine Eagleson spoke with Anchorage Daily News reporter Megan Holland outside the courthouse. Eagleson said that it was the emails that convinced the jurors of Michelle's guilt.
She explained, quote, "If you take one of those emails alone, then it doesn't have the same impact it does when you stack them up, like you would stack bricks. And I think when that happened, you ended up building something really large, and I think, undeniable," end quote.
Eagleson also admitted that Michelle's former life as a stripper influenced the jury as well. She told the reporter, "When you were soliciting yourself to be attractive sexually in all those ways, you were soliciting yourself in that manner for money. That all goes into the factor of manipulation and seduction. That was a whole key point that we discussed on and on and on."
Shortly after Michelle's trial ended, still waiting for his sentencing hearing, John Carlin gave an interview from jail to CBS's 60 Minutes. In the interview, he finally admitted to owning the .44 Desert Eagle.
He said that it was probably the gun that killed Kent, but claimed that it had disappeared around the time of the murder, only to reappear in the closet in his house shortly after Kent's death.
He corroborated young John's story of the gun falling out of the closet. John said he came upstairs and found Michelle in a panic. He said, quote, "I heard Michelle yelling at young John, 'Don't touch it, don't touch it,'" end quote.
Worried his son's fingerprints were now on the gun, John washed it with bleach in the bathroom sink. He said he got rid of the gun by throwing it into a dumpster.
When asked why he lied during the investigation, John said, quote, "It appeared to me that these people were coming after me. It looked very bad for me," end quote.
He went on to say that he didn't believe Michelle had pulled the trigger either, and that he had no idea who actually killed Kent.
One thing that he was certain about, however, was the effect that Michelle still had on him. He said, "It is indefinable. Whatever she needs to be, she is. You'll never, ever sit down and get Michelle. You never will. Not now, not 10 years from now. You will never get Michelle. You will get what she wants at that particular time to portray to you."
Next up, John Carlin and Michelle Linehan hope for leniency as the world waits to see how the judge will sentence them.
Now, back to the story.
In the fall of 2007, both John Carlin and Michelle Linehan were convicted of first-degree murder for their involvement in Kent Lepink's death. Judge Volland was tasked with determining the appropriate sentences for each.
When John Carlin arrived in court on November 7, 2007, Judge Volland had harsh words for him. He said the jury's verdict established that it was Mr. Carlin who lured Kent Lepink to Hope, that it was Mr. Carlin who pulled the trigger, and the last time he fired, most likely, was looking a dying Kent Lepink straight in the eyes.
Because of the calculated nature of the crime, Volland thought the maximum penalty was warranted. He sentenced Carlin to serve 99 years in prison. He would be eligible for parole in 33 years when he was 82.
A few days later, it was Michelle's turn. Her attorney made a compelling argument that Michelle had been adversely affected by the media frenzy surrounding John Carlin's trial. The statements made about Michelle by John's attorney, Sidney Billingsley, had prevented her from receiving a fair trial.
He said the Alaskan media focused a sensationalized spotlight on Michelle Linehan to such an extent that one would have thought it was she on trial rather than Mr. Carlin. The steady diet of scandalous Michelle Linehan stories many weeks before she stood trial, together with the incessant tabloid-esque media treatment of her trial, seriously compromised Michelle Linehan's case.
Eventually, it was Michelle's turn to speak. To the hushed courtroom, she said, quote, "I am not the monster that has been painted by the prosecution. I have not lived a life of greed, or that of this fictional character of a Hollywood movie that has been portrayed by the prosecution," end quote.
She then told the packed courtroom about her life as a loving wife and mother, and her work in the community as a crisis counselor, a stark contrast to the woman she was over a decade ago.
She also spoke about Kent, saying, quote, "The fact is, I considered him a friend. My reaction upon hearing of his death was horrible. My reaction was genuine. It is true that later in anger, I said things about him that were not kind, and I shouldn't have said those things," end quote.
Michelle begged Judge Volland to consider how her life had changed in the past 10 years. Quote, "I can only ask you to look at my life outside of the prosecution's attacks. Look at what and who I am by my peers, my family, my friends, my neighbors. I ask you when sentencing me that you look at all of these. I beg you from the bottom of my heart to allow me the chance to go back to my family as soon as I possibly can," end quote.
By all accounts, it was an emotional, powerful statement that left the courtroom stunned. But there were some people who weren't buying her story. Kent Lepink's parents, Betsy and Ken.
They were certain that Michelle was the mastermind behind their son's death and wanted her to pay the price. According to Betsy, "With all my heart, I felt it was a setup."
Judge Volland recognized that Michelle had lived a good life for the last 10 years, but quickly pointed out that Kent Lepink never had a chance to find that same happiness.
He continued, "It remains evident to me that people are clearly taken by Miss Linehan's charm and remain so today. And the evidence at trial also convinces me that she used that same charm to a criminal design."
he said he could see no distinction, quote, between the puppet who pulls the trigger and the puppeteer who pulls the strings. And in my judgment, Ms. Linehan was the puppeteer who pulled the strings, end quote.
Volland gave Michelle the same 99-year sentence as John Carlin. She would be eligible for parole when she was 68.
John Carlin was incarcerated at Spring Creek Correctional Center, a maximum security men's prison in Seward, Alaska. His time there was difficult from the start.
His argumentative nature and sometimes racist opinions did not endear him to his fellow inmates. A few months into his sentence, he was severely beaten by four other inmates.
Carlin was placed in protective custody, something he felt was punitive. He described it in a letter as similar to the primate section of a zoo.
But shortly after returning to the general prison population, John was attacked again. Fearing for his life, Carlin appealed to state officials for protection. Carlin believed his problems stemmed in part because the other prisoners were jealous of the media attention he was receiving. The state did not take John's complaints seriously.
He even wrote a letter to Anchorage Daily News reporter Megan Holland, begging her to help, saying he needed to be moved or protected before the other prisoners killed him.
Unfortunately, on October 27, 2008, John Carlin was attacked a third time in his cell and beaten to death.
The Alaska Department of Law launched an investigation into his death that lasted over 2 years. The report came to the conclusion that the Department of Corrections had dropped the ball in ensuring John's safety.
Young John sued the Alaska Department of Corrections for $500,000. The state settled in early 2015 with a payment of $160,000.
Michelle managed to find her way at Highland Mountain Correctional Center in Eagle River, Alaska. She busied herself with work, sewing prison uniforms and caring for abandoned dogs in a special program designed to rehabilitate both dogs and prisoners.
But she hadn't given up on winning back her freedom. She finally got her chance with an appeal hearing on December 3, 2009.
Michelle retained one of Alaska's leading criminal defense attorneys, Jeff Feldman. He presented Michelle's case before a three-judge panel of the Alaska Court of Appeals.
His arguments were, in brief, that inflammatory and inappropriate testimony had been allowed about the movie The Last Seduction. These irrelevant statements had tainted the jury, even though Judge Volland eventually instructed the jury to disregard it as evidence.
Feldman also made a case against the letter from the grave written by Kent Lepink. He argued that the letter was effectively testimony by the victim, who could not be cross-examined because he was dead. Therefore, it shouldn't have ever been presented at Michelle's trial.
The appeals court agreed. They ruled in February 2010 that the movie had no apparent connection to the Linehan case and that Kent's letter was inadmissible testimony. Michelle's first-degree murder conviction was overturned.
However, because her appeal was based on a mistrial, she would be retried without the prohibited evidence. She was only free to leave prison if she could post bail, as with the last trial.
Unfortunately, the Linehans were already $1 million in debt and unable to come up with the required $25,000 in cash and $225,000 in property assets.
But once again, men who were charmed by Michelle came through for her. The cash was posted by a Pennsylvania businessman, Brian Watt, and the property was put up by an Anchorage resident, Terry Stallman, who owned a local strip club.
Although grateful, Michelle admits she was initially leery of accepting their generosity. She said, "I've taken presents from men before that didn't want anything, and it didn't get me in a good place."
Even once she was out on bail, Michelle had to remain in Anchorage while she waited for her new trial, scheduled for April 2, 2012. She rented an apartment and got a job, hoping that she wouldn't be convicted a second time.
Ken and Betsy Lepink were devastated when they learned of Michelle's release. Despite Ken having some health problems, the couple made plans to travel to Alaska for the new trial.
But the second trial would never happen. In December of 2011, almost 2 years after her guilty verdict was overturned, Judge Volland ruled that the indictment should be thrown out entirely.
In addition to the letter from the grave being inadmissible, young John had recanted his testimony about seeing the Desert Eagle in his father's home. He told prosecutors that if he was called to the stand again, he would invoke his Fifth Amendment rights.
The prosecution no longer had sufficient evidence to indict Michelle. For the first time in 5 years, she was free.
After receiving the good news, Michelle made no statement and left the courtroom quietly with her husband, Colin. Within hours, she was on a plane to Olympia, free of her past.
But Kent's family would never be free of the events that occurred in 1996. Betsy said, "When you lose a child you love so very much, it never stops hurting. We'll miss Kent as long as we live."
Betsy continued to visit Alaska in the years that followed. She considered it the place that she felt closest to her son.
Although Michelle was free to go back to the life she had built in Olympia, the damage had been done in her marriage. She and Colin eventually separated, but remained on good terms.
Michelle opened a successful skincare clinic, and the two share custody of their teenage daughter.
Despite the fact that the cold case unit presented a compelling case, no one can truly say what happened to Kent in the desolate landscape of Hope, Alaska.
The Lepping family is still devastated by their loss and struggles with the fact that Michelle was never held accountable for his murder.
Although Michelle didn't pay the ultimate price for Kent's murder, she did lose the dream life that she had built.
Whether that meant she got off easy or was punished more than she deserved is still up for debate.
Thanks again for tuning in to the special crossover for Female Criminals and Crimes of Passion. We'll be back on Wednesday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Female Criminals, as well as all of Parcast's other podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
Join us next Wednesday as we continue to explore the minds of female criminals. Female Criminals was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler, additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Female Criminals is written by Desi Jadukin and stars Lainey Hobbs, Sammy Nye, and Vanessa Richardson.